but the basic crops and raw materials produced by the less developed countries are subject to sudden and wide-ranging shifts in market price. They do not share in the growing market value of industrial products. This poses serious difficulties to the developing nations. They depend on exports to a large extent for a balanced economy, and for further steps toward development. Thus the needy nations grow more destitute, while the rich nations become even richer. Free trade concept inadequate. 58. It is evident that the principle of free trade, by itself, is no longer adequate for regulating international agreements. It certainly can work when both parties are about equal economically. In such cases it stimulates progress and rewards effort. That is why industrially developed nations see an element of justice in this principle. But the case is quite different when the nations involved are far from equal. Market prices that are freely agreed upon can turn out to be most unfair. It must be avowed openly that, in this case, the fundamental tenet of liberalism, as it is called, as the norm for market dealings, is open to serious question. Justice at every level. 59. The teaching set forth by our predecessor Leo XIII in Rerum Novarum is still valid today. When two parties are in very unequal positions, their mutual consent alone does not guarantee a fair contract. The rule of free consent remains subservient to the demands of the natural law. 57. In Rerum Novarum this principle was set down with regard to a just wage for the individual worker, but it should be applied with equal force to contracts made between nations. Trade relations can no longer be based solely on the principle of free, unchecked competition, for it very often creates an economic dictatorship. Free trade can be called just only when it conforms to the demands of social justice. 60. As a matter of fact, the highly developed nations have already come to realize this. At times they take appropriate measures to restore balance to their own economy, a balance which is frequently upset by competition when left to itself. Thus it happens that these nations often support their agriculture at the price of sacrifices imposed on economically more favored sectors. Similarly, to maintain the commercial relations which are developing among themselves, especially within a common market, the financial, fiscal and social policy of these nations tries to restore comparable opportunities to competing industries which are not equally prospering. One standard for all. 61. Now in this matter one standard should hold true for all. What applies to national economies and to highly developed nations must also apply to trade relations between rich and poor nations. Indeed, competition should not be eliminated from trade transactions, but it must be kept within limits, so that it operates justly and fairly, and thus becomes a truly human endeavor. Now in trade relations between the developing and the highly developed economies there is a great disparity in their overall situation, and in their freedom of action. In order that international trade be human and moral, social justice requires that it restore to the participants a certain equality of opportunity. To be sure, this equality will not be attained at once, but we must begin to work toward it now, by injecting a certain amount of equality into discussions and price talks. Here again international agreements on a broad scale can help a great deal. They could establish general norms for regulating prices, promoting production facilities, and favoring certain infant industries. Isn't it plain to everyone that such attempts to establish greater justice in international trade would be of great benefit to the developing nations, and that they would produce lasting results? The obstacles of nationalism. 62. There are other obstacles to creation of a more just social order, and to the development of world solidarity, nationalism, and racism. It is quite natural that nations recently arrived at political independence should be quite jealous of their newfound but fragile unity, and make every effort to preserve it. It is also quite natural for nations with a long-standing cultural tradition to be proud of their traditional heritage. But this commendable attitude should be further ennobled by love, a love for the whole family of man. Haughty pride in one's own nation disunites nations and poses obstacles to their true welfare. It is especially harmful where the weak state of the economy calls for a pooling of information, efforts and financial resources to implement, programs of development and to increase commercial and cultural interchange and racism. 63. Racism is not the exclusive attribute of young nations, where sometimes it hides beneath the rivalries of clans and political parties, with heavy losses for justice, and at the risk of civil war. During the colonial period it often flared up between the colonists and the indigenous population, and stood in the way of mutually profitable understanding, often giving rise to bitterness in the wake of genuine injustices. It is still an obstacle to collaboration among disadvantaged nations and a cause of division and hatred within countries, whenever individuals and families see the inviolable rights of the human person held in scorn, as they themselves are unjustly subjected to a regime of discrimination, because of their race or their color. Hopes for the future. 64. This state of affairs, which bodes ill for the future, causes us great distress and anguish. But we cherish this hope, that distrust and selfishness among nations will eventually be overcome by a stronger desire for mutual collaboration and a heightened sense of solidarity. We hope that the developing nations will take advantage of their geographical proximity to one another to organize on a broader territorial base and to pool their efforts for the development of a given region. We hope that they will draw up joint programs, coordinate investment funds wisely, divide production quotas fairly, and exercise management over the marketing of these products. We also hope that multilateral and broad international associations will undertake the necessary work of an organization to find ways of helping needy nations, so that these nations may escape from the fetters now binding them, so that they themselves may discover the road to cultural and social progress, while remaining faithful to the natives' genius of their land, the artisans of destiny. 65. That is the goal toward which we must work. An ever more effective world solidarity should allow all peoples to become the artisans of their destiny. Up to now, relations between nations have too often been governed by force. Indeed, that is the hallmark of past history. May the day come when international relationships will be characterized by respect and friendship, when mutual cooperation will be the hallmark of collaborative efforts, and when concerted effort for the betterment of all nations will be regarded as a duty by every nation. The developing nations now emerging are asking that they be allowed to take part in the construction of a better world, a world which would provide better protection for every man's rights and duties. It is certainly a legitimate demand, so everyone must heed and fulfill it. Worldwide brotherly love. 66. Human society is sorely ill. The cause is not so much the depletion of natural resources, nor their monopolistic control by a privileged few. It is rather the weakening of brotherly ties between individuals and nations. Welcoming the stranger. 67. We cannot insist too much on the duty of giving foreigners a hospitable reception. It is a duty imposed by human solidarity and by Christian charity, and it is incumbent upon families and educational institutions in the host nations. Young people, in particular, must be given a warm reception. More and more families and hostels must open their doors to them. This must be done, first of all, that they may be shielded from feelings of loneliness, distress, and despair that would sap their strength. It is also necessary, so that they may be guarded against the corrupting influence of their new surroundings, where the contrast between the dire poverty of their homeland and the lavish luxury of their present surroundings is, as it were, forced upon them. And finally, it must be done so that they may be protected from subversive notions and temptations to violence, which gain headway in their minds when they ponder their wretched plight. 58. In short, they should be welcomed in the spirit of brotherly love, so that the concrete example of wholesome living may give them a high opinion of authentic Christian charity and of spiritual values. 68. We are deeply distressed by what happens to many of these young people. They come to wealthier nations to acquire scientific knowledge, professional training, and a high-quality education that will enable them to serve their own land with greater effectiveness. They do get a fine education, but very often they lose their respect for the priceless cultural heritage of their native land, 69. Immigrant workers should also be given a warm welcome. Their living conditions are often inhuman, and they must scrimp on their earnings in order to send help to their families who have remained behind in their native land in poverty. A social sense. 70. We would also say a word to those who travel to newly industrialized nations for business purposes. Industrialists, merchants, managers and representatives of large business concerns. It often happens that in their own land they do not lack a social sense. Why is it, then, that they give in to baser motives of self-interest when they set out to do business in the developing countries? Their more favored position should rather spur them on to be initiators of social progress and human betterment in these lands. Their organizational experience should help them to figure out ways to make intelligent use of the labor of the indigenous population, to develop skilled workers, to train engineers and other management men, to foster these people's initiative, and prepare them for offices of ever greater responsibility. In this way they will prepare these people to take over the burden of management in the near future. In the meantime, justice must prevail in dealings between superiors and their subordinates. Legitimate contracts should govern these employment relations, spelling out the duties involved. And no one, whatever his status may be, should be unjustly subjected to the arbitrary whim of another. Development missions. 71. We certainly rejoice over the fact that an ever-increasing number of experts are being sent on development missions by private groups, bilateral associations and international organizations. These specialists must not act as overlords, but as helpers and fellow workers. 59. The people of a country soon discover whether their new helpers are motivated by goodwill or not, whether they want to enhance human dignity or merely try out their special techniques. The expert's message will surely be rejected by these people if it is not inspired by brotherly love. The role of experts. 72. Technical expertise is necessary, but it must be accompanied by concrete signs of genuine love, untainted by overbearing nationalistic pride or any trace of racial discrimination. Experts should learn how to work in collaboration with everyone. They must realize that their expert knowledge does not give them superiority in every sphere of life. The culture which shaped their living habits does contain certain universal human elements, but it cannot be regarded as the only culture, nor can it regard other cultures with haughty disdain. If it is introduced into foreign lands, it must undergo adaptation. Thus those who undertake such work must realize they are guests in a foreign land. They must see to it that they studiously observe its historical traditions, its rich culture, and its peculiar genius. A rapprochement between cultures will thus take place, bringing benefits to both sides. Service to the world. 73. Sincere dialogue between cultures, as between individuals, paves the way for ties of brotherhood. Plans proposed for man's betterment will unite all nations in the joint effort to be undertaken, if every citizen, be he a government leader, a public official, or a simple workman, is motivated by brotherly love and is truly anxious to build one universal human civilization that spans the globe. Then we shall see the start of a dialogue on man, rather than on the products of the soil or of technology. This dialogue will be fruitful if it shows the participants how to make economic progress, and how to achieve spiritual growth as well. If the technicians take the role of teachers and educators, if the training provided is characterized by a concern for spiritual and moral values, so that it ensures human betterment as well as economic growth, then the bonds of solidarity will endure, even when the aid programs are past and gone. It is not plain to all that closer ties of this sort will contribute immeasurably to the preservation of world peace. An appeal to youth. 74. We are fully aware of the fact that many young people have already responded wholeheartedly to the invitation of our predecessor Pius XII, summoning the laity to take part in missionary work. 60. We also know that other young people have offered their services to public and private organizations that seek to aid developing nations. We are delighted to learn that in some nations their requirement of military duty can be fulfilled, in part at least, by social service, or Simply, service. We commend such undertakings and the men of goodwill who take part in them. Would that all those who profess to be followers of Christ might heed his plea, "I was hungry, and you gave me to eat, I was thirsty, and you gave me to drink, I was a stranger, and you took me in, naked and you covered me, sick and you visited me, I was in prison and you came to me." 61. No one is permitted to disregard the plight of his brothers living in dire poverty, enmeshed in ignorance, and tormented by insecurity. The Christian, moved by this sad state of affairs, should echo the words of Christ, "I have compassion on the crowd." 62. Prayer and action. 75. Let everyone implore God the Father Almighty, that the human race, which is certainly aware of these evils, will bend every effort of mind and spirit to their eradication. To this prayer should be added the resolute commitment of every individual. Each should do as much as he can, as best he can, to counteract the slow pace of progress in some nations. And it is to be hoped that individuals, social organizations and nations will join hands in brotherly fashion, the strong aiding the weak, all contributing their knowledge, their enthusiasm and their love to the task, without thinking of their own convenience. It is the person who is motivated by genuine love, more than anyone else, who pits his intelligence against the problems of poverty, trying to uncover the causes, and looking for effective ways of combating and overcoming them. As a promoter of peace, he goes on his way, holding aloft the torch of joy, and shedding light and grace on the hearts of men all over the world. He helps them to cross the barriers of geographical frontiers, to acknowledge every man as a friend and brother. 63. Development, the new name for peace. 76. Extreme disparity between nations in economic, social, and educational levels provokes jealousy and discord, often putting peace in jeopardy. As we told the Council Fathers on our return from the United Nations, we have to devote our attention to the situation of those nations still striving to advance. What we mean, to put it in clearer words, is that our charity toward the poor, of whom there are countless numbers in the world, has to become more solicitous, more effective, more generous. 64. When we fight poverty, and oppose the unfair conditions of the present, we are not just promoting human well-being, we are also furthering man's spiritual and moral development, and hence we are benefiting the whole human race. For peace is not simply the absence of warfare, based on a precarious balance of power. It is fashioned by efforts directed day after day toward the establishment of the ordered universe willed by God, with a more perfect form of justice among men. 65. 77. Nations are the architects of their own development, and they must bear the burden of this work, but they cannot accomplish it if they live in isolation from others. Regional mutual aid agreements among the poorer nations, broader-based programs of support for these nations, major alliances between nations to coordinate these activities, these are the road signs that point the way to national development and world peace, toward an effective world authority. 78. Such international collaboration among the nations of the world certainly calls for institutions that will promote, coordinate and direct it, until a new juridical order is firmly established and fully ratified. We give willing and wholehearted support to those public organizations that have already joined in promoting the development of nations, and we ardently hope that they will enjoy ever-growing authority. As we told the United Nations General Assembly in New York, your vocation is to bring, not just some peoples, but all peoples together as brothers. Who can fail to see the need and importance of thus gradually coming to the establishment of a world authority capable of taking effective action on the juridical and political planes? 66. Hope for the future. 79. Some would regard these hopes as vain flights of fancy. It may be that these people are not realistic enough, and that they have not noticed that the world is moving rapidly in a certain direction. Men are growing more anxious to establish closer ties of brotherhood, despite their ignorance, their mistakes, their offenses, and even their lapses into barbarism and their wanderings from the path of salvation. They are slowly making their way to the Creator, Even without adverting to it, this struggle toward a more human way of life certainly calls for hard work and imposes difficult sacrifices. But even adversity, when endured for the sake of one's brothers, and out of love for them, can contribute greatly to human progress. The Christian knows full well that when he unites himself with the expiatory sacrifice of the divine Savior, he helps greatly to build up the body of Christ. 67. To assemble the people of God into the fullness of Christ. A final appeal. 80. We must travel this road together, united in minds and hearts. Hence we feel it necessary to remind everyone of the seriousness of this issue in all its dimensions, and to impress upon them the need for action. The moment for action has reached a critical juncture. Can countless innocent children be saved? Can countless destitute families obtain more human living conditions? Can world peace and human civilization be preserved intact? Every individual and every nation must face up to this issue, for it is their problem. To Catholics. 81. We appeal, first of all, to our sons. In the developing nations, and in other countries, lay people must consider it their task to improve the temporal order. While the hierarchy has the role of teaching and authoritatively interpreting the moral laws and precepts that apply in this matter, the laity have the duty of using their own initiative and taking action in this area without waiting passively for directives and precepts from others. They must try to infuse a Christian spirit into people's mental outlook and daily behavior, into the laws and structures of the civil community. 68. Changes must be made, present conditions must be improved, and the transformations must be permeated with the spirit of the gospel. We especially urge Catholic men living in developed nations to offer their skills and earnest assistance to public and private organizations, both civil and religious, working to solve the problems of developing nations. They will surely want to be in the first ranks of those who spare no effort to have just and fair laws, based on moral precepts, established among all nations. To other Christians and believers. 82. All our Christian brothers, we are sure, will want to consolidate and expand their collaborative efforts to reduce man's immoderate self-love and haughty pride, to eliminate quarrels and rivalries, and repress demagoguery and injustice so that a more human way of living is open to all, with each man helping others out of brotherly love. Furthermore, we still remember with deep affection the dialogue we had with various non-Christian individuals and communities in Bombay. So once again we ask these brothers of ours to do all in their power to promote living conditions truly worthy of the children of God. To all men of goodwill. 83. Finally, we look to all men of goodwill, reminding them that civil progress and economic development are the only road to peace. Delegates to international organizations, public officials, gentlemen of the press, teachers and educators, all of you must realize that you have your part to play in the construction of a new world order. We ask God to enlighten and strengthen you all, so that you may persuade all men to turn their attention to these grave questions and prompt nations to work toward their solution. Educators, you should resolve to inspire young people with a love for the needy nations. Gentlemen of the press, your job is to place before our eyes the initiatives that are being taken to promote mutual aid, and the tragic spectacle of misery and poverty that people tend to ignore, in order to salve their consciences. Thus at least the wealthy will know that the poor stand outside their doors waiting to receive some leftovers from their banquets. To government authorities. 84. Government leaders, your task is to draw your communities into closer ties of solidarity with all men, and to convince them that they must accept the necessary taxes on their luxuries and their wasteful expenditures, in order to promote the development of nations and the preservation of peace. Delegates to international organizations, it is largely your task to see to it that senseless arms races and dangerous power plays give way to mutual collaboration between nations, a collaboration that is friendly, peace-oriented, and divested of self-interest, a collaboration that contributes greatly to the common development of mankind, and allows the individual to find fulfillment. To thoughtful men. 85. It must be admitted that men very often find themselves in a sad state because they do not give enough thought and consideration to these things. So we call upon men of deep thought and wisdom, Catholics and Christians, believers in God and devotees of truth and justice, all men of goodwill, to take as their own Christ's injunction, "Seek and you shall find," 69, blaze the trails to mutual cooperation among men, to deeper knowledge and more widespread charity, to a way of life marked by true brotherhood, to a human society, based on mutual harmony, to all promoters of development. 86. Finally, a word to those of you who have heard the cries of needy nations, and have come to their aid. We consider you the promoters and apostles of genuine progress and true development. Genuine progress does not consist in wealth sought for personal comfort, or for its own sake. Rather, it consists in an economic order designed for the welfare of the human person, where the daily bread that each man receives reflects the glow of brotherly love and the helping hand of God. 87. We bless you with all our heart, and we call upon all men of goodwill to join forces with you as a band of brothers, knowing, as we all do, that development means peace these days. What man would not want to work for it with every ounce of his strength? No one, of course. So we beseech all of you to respond wholeheartedly to our urgent plea, in the name of the Lord. Given at Rome, at St. Peter's, on the Feast of the Resurrection, March 26, 1967, in the fourth year of our pontificate. PAUL 6.